Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 122. Let's talk about Israel. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we're excited today to continue this series exploring the present and future of the relationship between American Jews and Israel by speaking with a congregational rabbi who has taken this issue on as one that it's important to talk about from the pulpit, whereas many other rabbis have been trying to avoid it because it's so difficult to talk about. Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum is the spiritual leader of Congregation Beit Simcha Torah, the largest LGBT-founded synagogue in the world and a very prominent congregation based in New York. If you can think of an award that might go to a rabbi, Sharon Kleinbaum has won it. She was on many of the 50 most influential rabbis lists published by Newsweek magazine, as well as Newsweek's 150 Women Who Shake the World. She's been named one of the most influential Jewish leaders by The Forward and the New York Jewish Week, and she's the recipient of the Women of Valor Award from the Jewish Fund for Justice. Sharon Kleinbaum also serves on many different commissions and advisory groups in the city of New York, including the Police Department's LGBT Advisory Committee, Mayor Bill de Blasio's Transition Committee, and she's a commissioner on New York City's Commission on Human Rights. She has rabbinical ordination from the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College and has spoken and written broadly on subjects relating to the LGBT Jewish experience, social justice, and a variety of other topics. We are so excited to have her today on Judaism Unbound. Sharon Kleinbaum, welcome. It's so great to have you.
I'm very happy to be with you today.
Well, it's exciting to be able to talk to a congregational rabbi in this series that we're doing on the relationship between American Jews and Israel, because I think a lot of congregational rabbis don't really want to talk about it. And I worry that the fact that we don't talk about Israel in synagogues on a regular basis is actually interpreted by folks as, you know, we're not talking about what we need to be talking about, whether that means we're actively trying to hide it or get away from something, or it just sort of means like we're not doing the real thing here. But somehow it doesn't feel like it's attracting people. You know, and it's almost like contrary to the very purpose, which I think is that the rabbis are afraid that they're going to drive people away by talking about Israel. So I'm curious if you could give us a little bit of a kind of sense from the field as you see it, as a rabbi who is willing to talk about this stuff. You know, what do you think is going on in the hearts and minds of American Jews, whether they're sort of regular synagogue goers or not, that you feel like you've been seeing and responding to over the last number of years?
Well, I think it's a really complicated landscape, and you've really well described a piece of it. I do think that the issues facing Israel today are some of the most significant moral issues facing the Jewish people worldwide. And if we don't directly confront them and discuss them and engage and be connected and debate and really get our hands dirty, then we're avoiding what is really the greatest moral crisis facing the Jewish people today. But that doesn't mean it's a simple thing to do. And so I'm sympathetic to the rabbis who say, you know what, it's a third rail. Whatever I do, I'm going to get fried. So better for me not to enter into it. And we live in a world in which rabbis feel afraid of jobs or loss of income, or major donors have a particular position, or just it's such a major headache, it's really hard to deal with. So I'm sympathetic to how complicated it is. And I have experienced it here at CBST, which is our congregation here in New York City, Congregation Beit Simchat Torah. So when I first came to CBST in 1992, CBST was not a significantly progressive lefty synagogue by any means. It was a community of gay Jews who were very much, there's a lot of anxiety about being visible on a lot of issues because of what the world was like for gay people at the time. CBST was founded in 1973 by a very small group of gay people who wanted to do something totally radical, which was to be openly gay and deeply Jewish at the same time. Until that moment in 1973, those options did not exist. either you were gay and you had to leave the Jewish community if you were going to be open about it, or you could stay in the Jewish community, but you had to be super closeted or in denial or completely sublimate. So Israel was a complicated issue for CBST to be out and visible about in anything but a very pretty standard mainstream Jewish position. And what's really interesting about the queer world and Israel now is that there are tremendous divisions in the gay Jewish community itself around issues about Israel. We have people in the synagogue who are to the right of Likud and are on the, would say they're on the far right of the spectrum around Israel politics. And we have members of the synagogue who support BDS, who identify as anti-Zionist, and are very much in that camp. So we have an arrange here that's very complicated to negotiate. And this is where I hold American Jewish life really to task, not because I object to X, Y, or Z's particular position on Israel, but because I really object to what I think is censorship of a robust debate about really complicated issues. I don't personally support BDS, but I respect a lot of people who do. And why would I be afraid to discuss and engage in discussions about it? We Jews are an intellectual people, theoretically. We've been engaged in debate of ideas forever, theoretically. All of a sudden, this idea has become completely forbidden to even be raised in a Jewish setting. That I really object to. And I think we as a Jewish people are deeply hurt by not engaging with these issues directly and with honesty and integrity, which means disagreement. And I've been called unbelievable things. It only strengthens me that we need to be doing more of it. I take a lot of trips to Israel. This summer, I'm taking a trip of families with kids to Israel. And then in November, I'm taking a trip of adults to Israel, only without children. And in both of these, maybe my 9th and 10th congregational trips I've led to Israel in the 25 years I've been rabbi. And nothing deepens the congregation's sense of holding complex truths at once and being more and more sophisticated about discussing the issues. And I say to everybody who comes on a trip with me, I hope that if you come convinced that you know what the answer is from the left or from the right, you'll end up being more confused. That's what I can guarantee. And in that confusion, our people, I think, will find deep truth and some way to have some integrity as a people. You might know that in the 2014 Gaza war, I offered a blessing, not even a sermon. It was a blessing before a prayer for peace. It was August 1st, which was the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I. And I did it in the context of acknowledging in these 100 years since the beginning of the war, which was called the war to end all wars, how many children and young people have died in these 100 years. I read names of Palestinian children who had been killed, and that was only in the first few weeks, as well as Israeli soldiers. And I said, they're children too. And sending soldiers to war, these 18 and 19-year-olds, it's another way that we send children to war and die. So I read a list that included both. It went viral through social media world, newspaper articles, and people described that so many people from the synagogue resigned. Actually, three people resigned. Most of the people who resigned on social media were never members of the synagogue. And I kept making jokes with my board. I think we should charge them membership. They should have to pay something before they get the right to resign on social media in order to trash Kleinbaum. But three people did resign, and I had to withstand a lot of negative conflict. On the other hand, many people joined the synagogue. We got lots of donations from Jews out in the world who said, you know, kol hakavod, thank God somebody's willing to acknowledge these things. So it is a complicated story, and it's not fun. You know, a lot of people, we become rabbis because we want people to adore us, right? We want to be loved. We want to make people happy. And it is not fun to get attacked for being either a traitor to the Jewish people or hating Palestinians or being a monster. It's not fun. So I'm very sympathetic to my colleagues who want to stay away from it.
When you said being accused of being a traitor to the Jewish people. I was going to bring up about 25 years ago, maybe a little more, my uncle wrote a piece. My uncle was a prominent writer and activist in the LGBTQ world. And he wrote a piece called that was called Am I a Traitor to My People? And his name was Eric Rofus.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I knew him.
Yeah, there you go.
That's
yeah, he's probably my, for a variety of reasons, he's my Rebbe. I say he was not a rabbi, but he has taught me a lot. And he wrote a piece that was looking at the question of Israel and Palestine in the early 90s. And he was writing from a place, he was never a weekly synagogue goer. He was not, but he was deeply Jewish and wrote from a consciously Jewish place and sort of analyzed what it was to be Jewish and gay and bring up issues that you brought up earlier about how difficult it was to straddle those worlds in certain time periods. And he wrote about the challenges of speaking out against Israel in the early 90s and how conflicted he felt and how pulled he was in a variety of directions that related to his queer experience and that related to his Jewish experience and just political views more generally. And so I guess given that that was written in the early 90s, and we're talking about similar things now, it might feel like everything sort of stayed the same, but I'm suspicious that that's not the case. And I'd love to hear from you as somebody who's been in a congregational context, in an LGBTQ context and Jewish context specifically for multiple decades at this point. Has this intensified? Has this shifted in certain, what has changed around the role that Israel plays in Jewish life, maybe in general, and also in Jewish queer spaces?
Well, it's a really excellent question and a point, but the world has changed a lot since 1992 around issues, both LGBT and queer, and in terms of Israel and in the intersection. First of all, the Oslo Accords were signed in 93. So that was a time of tremendous optimism and hope. And there was a sense that those of us who were activists on behalf, those of us who believed, who considered ourselves, and I did then, to be pro-Israel, pro-Palestinian, and pro-peace, and had been actively working on behalf of peace and justice for Palestinians and Israelis for a long time. There was a big sense of hopefulness that the Oslo Accords represented a major breakthrough. And there was some sense that we were on the verge, we weren't there, but on the verge of tremendous opportunity for some concrete solutions for both the Palestinians and for Israelis. So that's the first thing that's changed, is that those hopes have been dashed and have been really destroyed. And depending on who you talk to, that's a piece of what the conflict is about now. People are very quick to blame whatever side they're not on for being responsible for destroying the hope of Oslo. But the reality on the ground is that Israel is the military power that is the occupying force of millions of people. And it is the most powerful army in the Middle East. My fear is that Israel still sees itself ultimately as a victim and with the weakness of a victim, and sees itself in a David and Goliath battle always, and the Israelis are the David and somehow the Palestinians are Goliath. And that sense of being a victim has made Israel very unable to really understand what power it does have. And by the way, it's a scary world, right? It's not that those fears are unfounded. And the Palestinians, likewise, they're just locked in a dance of death, and there has not been deep and profound leadership. But I do believe that part of the problem that we're at now is that we've been so locked into this dance of blame and of hatred, and that the two extremes of both positions, and it's too simplistic to say there are only two positions. The two extremes feed each other. Anytime there is a terrorist attack, it reinforces Bibi Netanyahu's 20 years of being in power, because he can then turn around to the people and say, nothing is as important as security. I'm the tough guy. I will make sure you're secure. Meanwhile, internal to Israel, there is a rot going on, both spiritually to its soul and economically to its economic system, that's being drained by this military occupation. So I fear for the soul of Israel, because I don't think it can, this is sustainable. And I fear for the real existential threat facing Israel is not the security threat from the countries who are genuinely threatening from the outside, because Israel has a very strong military presence. But internally, this occupation of millions of people is unsustainable. For me, as a progressive who cares about the future of Israel, I believe my position and all of my, any kind of capital I have, social, political, economic, should help to enforce the strength of the left inside of Israel, of the progressive voices inside of Israel. The big difference between South Africa and Israel, and I was somebody in the 70s very active in the divestment movement from South Africa, protesting apartheid, is that there was, it was illegal in South Africa to have an opposition. So in South Africa, if you opposed the apartheid regime, you were either had to go to exile, you got killed, or you were imprisoned. There wasn't a legal opposition. And in Israel, there is a progressive left that is fighting for the heart and soul of Israel. And I feel like the left in America has abandoned the left inside of Israel. And BDS, in many ways inside of Israel, only strengthens Bibi Netanyahu. He loves talking about it. He loves using it as a way to show the world is against Israel and strengthening the real anti-Israel left that exists, which is very powerful. And believe me, I think Israel helps to support that. It is a much more complicated position I'm taking, and it's a much more, it's nuanced, and it leaves me with not so many friends, right? So there's a queer gay world now, which has completely embraced an anti-Israel pro-BDS position. And queer people are disproportionately represented in that world. And I understand it. While I disagree with it, I understand it. On the right, and this also exists in my community, are people who believe that Palestinians are basically the Amalek of our generation. They are the, in every generation we Jews are taught, there are people who will kill us and destroy us. That, I think, is just too simplistic a perspective, and I reject the idea. But what happens for my people who believe that that's true, and that if we let down our guard, we Jews will be destroyed? My question for rabbis is, how do we talk about all of this? How do we just bring it out of the closet and engage in it? And it's not easy, because people, you know, they go nuts.
And that's really what I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, even on your bio on the synagogue's website, it talks about how you came to CBST during the AIDS crisis and how your pastoral presence was so important at that time in that community, as we all can understand. And so I really want to talk to you on the level of sort of the rabbi as pastor and psychologist and understanding what's going on with people. And because I worry that that's a place where our rabbis have kind of fallen down on the job, in that because of the fear that you talked about, which of course we all understand, and frankly, we're struggling with the same fears in doing this series of episodes and you know, decided to lean into it. But who in our community is there that has the potential to understand the what's going on psychologically with all the different parties and to try to create a presence that says, hey, let's find a different way to talk about this. We have to allow everybody to express what they feel. And yet we have to sort of build an environment where that can be done. And I guess before sort of talking about sort of what rabbis can do and why rabbis aren't doing it, what I'm really trying to get at is this question of, you know, why is it that in the environment of Judaism today, in particular about Israel, that we have embraced the tradition, which I think we have to admit is a counter narrative in Jewish tradition, of fundamentalism, right? We all talk about how Judaism was all about debate and discussion. And certainly there is a strong and important strain of that represented, for example, by the Talmud. But there's also a strong and important strain of fundamentalism and of the inability to talk to one another that perhaps is represented by the Maccabees. And it seems that we are leaning in that direction today. And I guess I'm asking you why.
Well, I don't think this is only our people's problem, in the sense of, I think we live in a larger cultural context of you know, authoritarianism, of judgmentalism. In those moments, people become very, very fearful. And fear is a very difficult place from which to make decisions to, and it's not a place that most people can have soft edges. When people are afraid, they get very rigid. It happens kind of politically and morally and socially, and people feel attacked. They feel like this is the end of the Jewish people. I understand they get very rigid and that, and really fearful. And I'm very moved by some of the movements that are happening among young Jews who are saying, we don't want to live that way anymore. Listen, after the election took place, the Friday after the election of November of 16, I woke up that morning and I thought, God, I feel really afraid. You know, what's going to happen? And I thought, but what about Muslim Americans? How do they feel this morning when they are going to their weekly Jumu'ah prayer service, which is their major communal service, in a country that has just put into office a man whose entire campaign was based on his opening speech, which was anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant? How do they feel? So I'm connected with an imam here in New York, and I asked a few of the clergy on staff with me here to meet me at the mosque with 100 red roses and signs we made on the subway that said, Jewish New Yorkers stand with our Muslim neighbors. And I saw as people started approaching, you could see them. Who are these people standing in front? Are they protesters? Are they anti-Muslim? And as they saw our signs and as we handed out the roses, there were tears, hugs. They wanted to take selfies with us to send to their mother to say, look, you know, look, there are people in New York, of course. And every Friday since then, CBST has had a presence at the mosque. We can't necessarily impact some of the biggest issues, but we can make relationships with Muslims here in New York City, cross barriers, acknowledging that there might be some differences we have, but saying, in how do we see each other as human beings? Every single Friday, we have congregants and clergy there. How many Jews actually are connected to human beings who are Muslim, who actually know human beings, know their names, know their families, have eaten a meal with them, have, you know, schmoozed with them? And that is part of the problem. We Jews are very separated from the Muslim world, from the Arab world, and of course they're not the same. And I think it's one of the great successes of the congregation. So now we have hundreds of congregants who now know individual Muslims. We don't agree on everything. That's not the point. Who agrees with anybody on everything? Why would we even consider that the requirement for having or being engaged in relationship?
But I mean, I guess I'm curious now, like, how would this look if it were applied to our fellow Jews? You know, like, what do we need to do? And in particular, I guess, like, right, again, I'm sort of suggesting, and I'd love for our rabbi listeners to get back to us about this. You know, as I hear you talk about this and talk about what you're doing in your congregation, I feel all the more so that if rabbis are choosing to not talk about Israel, as opposed to playing this pastoral presence to help us do whatever we need to do as fellow Jews in talking about this, then at the end of the day, gee, what do we really need rabbis for? You know, if they're not doing the most basic thing that we need, so what would it look like for them to be able to do it, especially in the face of all the pressures and all the anger and all the, you know, threatened donations to be taken away sort of stuff that you talked about?
Well, and those are really real. You know, the generation of rabbis being able to speak about whatever they want to speak about from their pulpit doesn't exist anymore. Because my job, I mean, yes, and I have people, and I just met with a congregant who came to meet with me last week who's angry and furious with me that I ever speak critically of Israel, that he feels like the world is so dangerous for Jews, we can't afford having rabbis speak critically of Israel. Even if he's somewhat sympathetic, he feels, I have to spend a lot of time really talking to people who are upset about that. Listen, would we be comfortable with rabbis who took positions that are not popular for, you know, the progressive world? What about an anti-gay rabbi? I actually support that. I personally believe it's important for rabbis to be able to take political positions. There's obviously going to be feedback and how to create a container in which they can happen. But listen, there are a lot of people who hate me. There are a lot of people who, it's not like you can measure my success because you won't find me getting trashed in social media from people on the left and people on the right. It depends what you mean by success. I'm lucky, and also I've been here 25 years. I've done a lot of pastoral work with the congregation for a long time. And what I spoke recently to a group of rabbinical students, and I said, listen, on some level, you have to understand, if you don't show, as a congregational rabbi, if you don't show up to the hospital room, you can't show up to the rally and give a speech. And that's hard. It takes a lot of time to do everything. I've built up a fantastic team of clergy at CBSD over these years. So we have a team to be able to do a lot of the work. But, you know, I know of a rabbi who left the synagogue and charges that the reason that they left the synagogue was because of politics. But I actually know that the congregants were upset that this rabbi stopped really showing up at the hospital, stopped doing weddings and stopped doing funerals in a way that made the congregation feel taken care of. So it's too easy to just say our congregants aren't going to support us. That's what the job is. The problem is it's a big job. It's really hard.
I often don't know whether a question is a gear shift or not. This might be a shift of gears, but it might be all very related. And the question I have relates to something you briefly mentioned earlier, which was the point that in the BDS movement, or maybe in general, on the left with respect to Israel-Palestine, there are disproportionately high numbers of folks who are queer. And I figured I'd share a quick anecdote. I was involved a number of years ago with planning the Open Hillel conference. Open Hillel, who we're about to speak with on Judaism Unbound in the next few weeks. And we did some internal measuring of who was there. And at the end of the conference, the stat that struck me most was that over one in three, it was somewhere around 35% of the people who attended this conference identified as queer, identified as gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, non-binary. And that was, I mean, I knew going into that, okay, so in general, we understand intersectionally that people who are positioned on the margins of society in certain kinds of ways may also end up viewing a variety of issues, Israel-Palestine included, from vantage points that are seen as countercultural. That's not surprising, but to see it at that level was stunning for me. And so I guess I'd just love to hear from you, like, what's at play here for why there are so many folks, maybe within your congregation, but maybe more generally in the LGBTQ orbit, who are deeply immersed in questions of Israel-Palestine in ways that those of us who aren't queer might not be. And what's your read on the factors that cause these issues perhaps to intersect in ways we might not be thinking about?
It's a fascinating phenomenon, and there are some interesting overlaps. It's not only that there is a disproportionate number of LGBTQ, queer, non-binary folks involved in the BDS movement. There's also a very interesting parallel going on that for a lot of cisgendered gay men, they're very much in the pro-Israel movement. You know, the issue of pinkwashing, for instance, and the whole complex controversy around pinkwashing, whether or not the state of Israel uses its politically progressive positions about LGBT rights to obfuscate its human rights abuses towards Palestinians, has, I think, brought the issue very much home to the LGBTQ world. Like, it is an issue that's that makes it very much alive for the queer world. I've been active in Israeli politics, you know, for 40 years and watched the fight for LGBTQ rights inside of Israel. And it didn't come down from the government in a benevolent way. It was as a result of activists fighting very, very, very hard. And all of those rights came from Supreme Court decisions. The parliament, the Knesset is never, and the government has never ruled in favor of gay people. It's all come from Supreme Court decisions that have been argued and brought by activists. And yes, it is true that Netanyahu, when he comes to the West, he loves to brag about gay rights as a way to try and say how progressive Israel is. I happen to think that it's possible to hold multiple truths at once. Israel has very good positions on gay rights that have been achieved by the fights of activists, and it also does violate the human rights of Palestinians. The queer world, because of what is now called pinkwashing, it creates a way into the issue that's not just intersectionality, but queerness is being used by the queerness, gay issues are being used by the Israeli government in ways that many gay people can be offended by. So I think that's that contributes another layer of interest and explanation. But I do think that the intersectionality one is powerful as well, and just the sense of being outsiders and watching Israel behave in such ways has particular resonance.
I'd love to home in a little bit more on the question of boundary policing that happens in the Jewish world, because I know you've spoken out really actively about those kinds of issues. And I mean, for me, it's so powerful. I mean, it's fascinating to hear from someone like you who says that they actively promote the speech rights of those who would restrict yours. I mean, you said earlier that you actively support the right of rabbis who don't approve of gay and lesbian relationships, for example, to espouse those views. And I think that to hear that from somebody who is directly oppressed by that ideology is, I mean, honestly, it's incredible to me. And I part of me deeply admires that. And part of me is also like, wait, really? And so I'd love to poke more into that, because what we see in the Jewish world is a variety of different kinds of red lines, but most prominently or close to most prominently, we see many institutional policies that directly restrict what kinds of views about Israel are permissible in certain structures. And this is prominent in Hillel, but it's also prominent in Federation life. It's prominent in all sorts of, and sometimes it's more implicit than explicit, but there's all of these boundaries being created. And I guess I'd love to hear more from you why that's so self-defeating, and also maybe beyond self-defeating, also defeating of those who are actually being restricted. Like what do those policies do?
Of course, I support the religious rights of people to believe things that are anathema to me, because I believe it doesn't mean I'm going to agree with them. It doesn't mean I'm going to not debate them. I actually have a lot of confidence in my points of view, so I'm happy to debate somebody. And if their points of view were able to convince me differently than what I think, then I really should be open to hearing what they have to say. I mean, the idea that I'm somehow going to be afraid of their ideas, I think it just strikes me as anti-Jewish. And I'm really afraid of a world in which people cannot do that. And we're well on that way. So yeah, of course I support people's rights to believe things differently than I do around gay issues, which is obviously another big axis in the Jewish community. Obviously in the liberal Jewish community, I've watched in the 40 years of my adult activism, I've seen those changes happen. But I also know those changes can be ephemeral. And I don't assume they're here forever. And I think people are a little too quick to only feel safe if they don't hear ideas that they disagree with. When I first became very public as a gay activist, of course I engaged with people who deeply disagreed with me. If I didn't, there wouldn't have been a lot of people to talk to. What the world was like 40 years ago, I'm 59 now. I came out when I was 18 years old. If I didn't talk to and engage with and push and prod and listen to people who disagreed with me, there would have been very few people to talk to. And how would I have had an impact on changing what they think? Now we have to worry about whether when ideas are codified into law. But for instance, I say publicly, I have for years and I continue to say, I completely support the right of a rabbi, a priest, a minister, imam, anybody to not do marriage for a same-sex couple. They have the right to say they won't do that marriage. I just think civilly, they shouldn't have the right to decide that American civil law doesn't respect same-sex people getting civil rights. If a church or a synagogue or a mosque doesn't want to marry gay people, they have every right to do that. It's different when they codify it into law.
the other dimension of Israel that is sort of doesn't get talked about all that much because the Israel-Palestine is, you know, probably rightly, you know, occupying the lion's share of the attention. But particularly when we're talking about liberal Jews and we think about sort of the religious pluralism issues going on in Israel, the question sort of in my mind is at what point is it going to get so bad that liberal American Jews are sort of would rightly say, look, I mean, this isn't my place anymore, right? I mean, it's not a place that where people who believe that Judaism is what I believe it is are really going to be sort of recognized by this country as practicing Judaism. And so then if it's a Jewish state, what difference does it make? It's not a Jewish state about the kind of Judaism that I practice. And the question is there a point at which it kind of gets too far gone where it seems unlikely that it's ever going to go back in that direction? And that's one of these questions that I'm trying to wrap my mind around in terms of looking at religious pluralism and worrying that at the end of the day, more Jews will end up being alienated by feeling like this isn't a Jewish state that's around the Judaism that I practice or that I want, versus, you know, the question of what's going on with the relationship of Israel and Palestinians.
Ironically, of course, the more that progressive or liberal Jews disengage, the more likely that scenario is going to happen. So part of me is a bit of a Dafkanik, as you get the sense of. I'm a little bit of a, you know, contrary type person, which is, I'm not going to let them win. I have this little feeling of, yeah, okay, the odds are against me. Okay, it's a climb up Mount Everest. But when I came out in 1977 as an 18-year-old, there was not a single marker anywhere in the world in which I lived that it was going to be okay to get married in 2018. Nothing. Who are we as Jews to give up because the odds look bad? Who are we as Jews to give up because it seems impossible to achieve something? Sure, the odds are great against me in a million different ways, but I refuse to give up just because the odds are bad. And I feel committed to those people inside of Israel who are fighting hard for its heart and soul. I admire them so deeply. And I'm not going to give up on them or on the fight to make Israel reflect the deepest Jewish values that I have, which means both the internal Israel and the policies inside of Israel, as well as policies that impact Palestinians inside of Israel and outside. I'm not always optimistic, but I'm always hopeful.
So a number of years ago, I heard you compare and contrast Israel and the role that Israel plays as sort of a divisive factor in Jewish life with the role that God plays, which on its surface might feel like it should be a more divisive issue, but as we know in many American Jewish contexts, isn't. And I'd love to hear from you just what are you getting at when you compare Israel and its role to that of God?
It strikes me as odd that you can go into almost any synagogue in the world, whether it's Orthodox, conservative, Reconstructionist, Reform, whatever, and say, Rabbi, I do not believe in God. The rabbi would invite you over for Shabbos lunch, would sit you down, would debate with you, would show you texts throughout history about how different Jews have felt about this. Or if you said, Rabbi, I'm angry at God, or I think God is a petulant, angry, punishing figure in the Tanakh, the rabbi would pull out books and sit with you and talk to you about it and argue with you, etc. But if you go into most of these synagogues and say, Rabbi, I don't believe in the state of Israel, you'd be thrown out. You wouldn't have a place in those synagogues. That's what strikes me as completely bizarre. If God is strong enough to be able to have Jews question God's existence or question God's behavior or be angry at God, which is throughout Jewish literature an appropriate and often cited examples of the great rabbis being angry at God. But somehow Israel isn't strong enough to withstand that kind of scrutiny or disbelief or anger. That's ridiculous to me. That is just on the surface ridiculous to me.
But that's sort of my question is like, so one interpretation of that is that God is strong enough to take it, but Israel isn't. And another interpretation of that is at the end of the day, the rabbis, they don't really believe in God that much either, right? You know, but Israel, they believe in, you know, for whatever reason. And I don't know what it is, but I'm struck by exactly the same thing that you described. Like Spinoza was excommunicated because of God, but nobody would be excommunicated because of God today.
Well, I think in fairness, and this is where there are multiple realities we have to hold at once, which is exhausting and complicated. So in reality, there's raging, virulent anti-Semitism in the world today. Absolutely, on the right and on the left. And there are anti-Semites who use anti-Israel rhetoric as ammunition. But that doesn't mean all criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. But yes, some anti-Semites are definitely using Israel as part of their ammunition. Mm-hmm. Well, those are kind of complicated things to hold. And when you hear anti-Semites using Israel, it's easy to say, okay, we've got to build up the barriers. We've got to protect ourselves. This isn't about whether Israel is doing this or that. This is just anti-Jew hatred. We've seen it before. We know how it plays out. We know how it ends. Somebody pointed out to me recently that in Charlottesville, when the KKK and the other white supremacist groups were marching, their chant was, "Jews will not replace us." And it took CNN 3 days to actually identify that the chant was, "Jews will not replace us." And it had been reported for 3 days that they just were saying, "You will not replace us." So at the heart of anti-Semitism is this white supremacist movement here in America. So I understand there is real fear. It is not without a base. So I get that. And I really believe that anti-Semitism is on the rise and we Jews are at tremendous risk right now. Well, fear creates a lot of anxiety. So I do understand that and I respect it. We have to insist and support our Jewish communities to be open places of robust debate. If we're not in positions of leadership, to sit down with the leaders and say, "I support you for helping to create this institution," whatever institution it is, whether it's your local synagogue or JCC or federation, to be places where real ideas can be discussed, where people can be respected to intellectually process and come to their own ideas and thoughts. And I urge people not to just give up on those positions with whom we have serious disagreements, whichever direction they go. And we've got to be a little countercultural, which is to demand the right of humanity to remain human. And it's not easy within our Jewish community to do that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation. We're excited to ruminate on all of the important issues you've brought up.
I've really enjoyed it, and nice to meet both of you.
And thanks to all of you out there for joining us in listening as well. We hope that you will be in touch with us with any questions, thoughts, concerns, arguments, yells, whatever you want to send our way. And there's a variety of ways for you to do that. And the first is that you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can hit up Twitter at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we'd like to make is that you can always support us with a financial donation. We really like that one. You can definitely do that one. You can do it either on a monthly basis or a one-time basis, and either can happen at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.